As I was sitting, I was thinking how grateful I am to be here. So thank you so much for inviting me to come today. Thank you. Recently, I've been thinking a lot about mindfulness. It seems like it's one of those topics that we think, oh yeah, we've heard it, right? We know about mindfulness. At least that was my position. And I thought, oh, no, not mindfulness. But it kept showing up in various ways. And most recently, one of them was on mindfulness, mindful eating. I'm still digesting that one. It's a book by Jan Chosen Bay. And then, lo and behold, she wrote another book. Oh, my goodness. How to Train a Wild Elephant. Mm-hmm. That's our mind, I'm pretty sure. My mind. So, mindfulness it is. So I went back into the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, which is, of course, the four foundations of mindfulness. It is the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. And it's my understanding that Mike has spoken on this, Michael Newhall has already spoken on this sutra. So I merely refer to it as, you know, a refresher for what are the four foundations of mindfulness. In addition today, besides using that text, but I also am referring to this, and then some of you may know or may not know about Dogen's four foundations of mindfulness. So it's from the extensive record, Dogen's extensive record. Then there's, on top of that, there's another book that's called Mindfulness in Plain English. It's actually a wonderful book. My own teacher had given me a copy years back, and I found it very useful. So I resurrected that one from the library, and so you'll be hearing some thoughts from that book as well. So the four foundations of mindfulness are contemplating mindfulness of the body, contemplating mindfulness of feelings, contemplating the mind, and contemplating mind objects. Having put aside covetousness and grief for the world. That's a quote from the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. So this sutra is about purifying the mind using vipassana meditation, where you're bringing awareness to the thoughts that arise, feelings that arise to the body, and so forth. So Shakyamuni, in instructing his disciples, stated that to contemplate the body as body, ardent, expressing or characterized by warmth of passion, displaying strong enthusiasm or devotion, but fully aware and mindful. And so this object, this phrase of saying, contemplating the object as it is, setting aside desire and grief for the world, provide us with some details of how to proceed. The instruction is to bring attention to whatever is. That means every aspect of your activities, your thoughts, or feelings. our ancestor Dogen had expressed his four foundations of mindfulness in the Dharma Hall Discourse 310, which reads, "Our Buddha, Shakyamuni, said to his disciples, 'There are four foundations of mindfulness on which people should depend. These four foundations of mindfulness refer to contemplating the body as impure, contemplating cessation as suffering, contemplating mind as impermanent, and contemplating phenomena as non-substantial.'" He goes on, "I, Ehe, also have four foundations of mindfulness. Contemplating the body as skin bag. Contemplating sensation as eating bowls. Contemplating mind as fences, walls, tiles, and pebbles. And contemplating phenomena as old man Zhang drinking wine, old man Lee getting drunk." "Great assembly, are my four foundations of mindfulness the same or different from the ancient Buddha's four foundations of mindfulness?" If you say they are the same, your eyebrows will fall out from lying. If you say they are different, you will lose your body and life. Leave it to Dogen to challenge us, right? So let's consider the sameness and difference, aka Dogen's metaphors of his four foundations of mindfulness with Shakyamuni's. Skin bag. That sounds like an interesting phrase to describe our body. Some of you may be familiar with the use of that phrase from our ancestor. He preceded Dogen several hundred years prior. His name is Shitou Xitian. And he is the author of Song of the Grass Hut, as well as Harmony of Sameness and Difference, Sandokai. So, skin bag. So if we look back at the original teaching from Shakyamuni, other elements that are part of things we should consider as body is the elements in the body, you know, the four elements, water, wind, earth. I think that's three. Water, wind, earth.
Fire.
Fire, thank you. Thank you.
You can't yell fire in here.
Where's that water when you need it? And Shakyamuni also looked at the elements, the consuming of food, the processes of the body, and then the foulness of the body and the decomposition of the body. You know, those, it's all related to contemplating body as body. Now, contemplating bowls as sensation, thank you. Feelings, singular or plural, taste, touch, sight, sound. So I was thinking about the context for Dogen, which was really the monastery where Oryoki was a part of their everyday experience, multiple times a day. So contemplating sensation as eating bowls, you know, could explain some of this when we think about what does that What do we do when we eat? What do we see? What do we taste? What do we think about as with the mind as the food arrives to us? How does the food come to us? And why does Shakyamuni say that contemplating sensation as eating bowls is relative to, or related to, suffering? So in our meal chant, we have a statement about how we must consider how this food comes to us. The suffering of every form of life. So we eat to survive, whether it's vegetables or other consumables in our environment, fish or chicken or meat. So that could be one way to look at suffering and how for the mindfulness of feelings, or mindfulness is, from Dogen's perspective, when we contemplate sensation as eating bowls, there's more to consider. Contemplating mind as fences, walls, and tiles, and pebbles is what the mind apprehends. It's what the mind designates. It's what the mind labels in our experience. This is an aspect of mind, this appropriating, designating mind. So in going back to contemplating mind as impermanent, how are these impermanent? How are they permanent? Could ask that, as things deteriorate as quickly as we put them in order. Put a fence up and watch it deteriorate. That's true in really everything that's arising is also disintegrating. So impermanence. So I ask you, what else Dogen could have said about the mind, contemplating mind? And what's this about contemplating mind objects? In Dogen's phrase, where he states contemplating phenomena as old man Zhang drinking wine and old man Li getting drunk. Kind of stumps one, right? So, as typical Dogen style, he will refer to other ancestors' teachings. And thank goodness for footnotes. Because, you know, what would I know about this one? But let's consider Zhang and Li as Jones and Smith. Okay, if we think about those names, then it's not so far away. You know, here's old man Jones drinking wine and old man Smith getting drunk. Well, what's that about? You know, it's not so hard to understand. But here's the reference. It's to Yunmen's recorded sayings, and it's referring to the inconceivable interconnectedness of all beings, all different beings. And also, it's expressing that Dharma spreads beyond our usual modes of perceiving. So, I mean, maybe Jones and Smith both drank the same amount, but one got drunk, right? We know that in life. Some people can hold their liquor better than others. But yet, you know, they're both drinking. And they're both, what else are they? They're both empty of inherent self-existence. So their reality is shared at one level that we more frequently than not do not consider. Suchness or emptiness. We take what is presented to us and we believe it. It's just what we do as humans. We forget there's another part of reality that is our shared experience that connects us together in a way that it's really inconceivable. It's immeasurable. It's so hard to for us some to grasp this, that we must first experience it. And when we experience the nature of reality, then the statement of old man Zhang drinking and old man Li getting drunk can be possible. But there's more. So here's some other questions for you. I need some help on this. Great assembly, are my four foundations of mindfulness the same or different from ancient Buddha's four foundations of mindfulness? If you say they are the same, your eyebrows will fall out from line. If you say they are different, you will lose your body and life. Anybody have any thoughts on that one? You'll go for that. All right. That one. Yeah. So that was a common expression, you know, the eyebrows would fall out. I guess we have Pinocchio, your nose would grow long if you lied. So how are they the same, though, in some ways? Okay. So they're similar phenomena, right? Yeah. Similar kind of phenomena. Yes, go on, Sky. Mm-hmm. So how would you think when he says, if you say they are different, you lose your body and life? Would that be the other half of the question? Oh, okay. That's his trap.
You need to be mindful. There you
go. Okay.
Don't fall into the trap of trying to ask the question.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he's taking us really beyond he's tripping us up in his great ability to use words and phrases like none other. He's just so skilled. It's a going beyond birth and death in the second statement. So a state of mindfulness is a state of mental readiness. The mind is not burdened with preoccupations or bound by worries. Whatever comes up can be dealt with instantly. When you're truly mindful, your nervous system has a freshness and resiliency that supports your response. A problem arises and you simply deal with it. There's no dilly-dallying, no caught or in fear, running away. You're present with it. So how do we actually practically work with this? Thich Nhat Hanh has written a book very, you know, you know, I don't know, maybe decades back, it was called The Miracle of Mindfulness. And there's a great story in there about an emperor and a hermit. And it's titled The Three Wondrous Answers. So the question, so of course, what are the questions? What is the best way, best time to do each thing? Who are the most important people to work with? And the third one is, what is the most important thing to do at all times? So here's the story. The emperor had these questions, and he wasn't sure what were the answers. He wanted answers. And he had all these subjects, so he thought he'd query his subjects. And for 2 weeks, anybody could come forth and give them their answer to what these questions meant. And after that period of time, he realized that the answers were still unsatisfactory. And so he knew about this hermit up in the mountains, and he thought, I'm going to, you know, travel to meet him and pose these questions, and I know he will be able to answer them. So off he goes, and you know, it's quite a journey up the mountain, but he arrives around midday, and he's seen the hermit is busy hoeing his garden. Now, being the emperor, he figures, I'm going to ask my questions right here, right now. You know, so he did. And of course, he was ignored. The hermit just kept hoeing the garden. So, what to do? He patiently waited. And about an hour later, he's seen that the hermit, who's elderly, is, you know, getting tired. He's been busy hoeing this garden, and pretty rigorously so. And the emperor said, well, why don't you take a rest? You know, I'll hoe for a little while, give you a break. And so he does. And he hoes for about an hour. Seems to be able to continue. He goes another hour. And now the hermit's turn, and he sees the hermit. And the hermit asks the emperor, well, I think you need a break. You know, you've been working here. You're looking a little tired. Why don't you take a rest? Well, and I'll take over. And so he does. But the emperor says, but wait a minute. You know, my questions. Totally is ignored by the hermit. The hermit just goes right back to hoeing. But by now, it's starting to get dark. And, you know, the emperor is getting, you know, he's, well, wait a minute, you know, I came up here, this guy's not answering my questions. What's the story here? So he asks them again. And the hermit responds by saying, hey, don't you hear something coming? Do you hear someone running? Do you hear that? And the emperor says, no. And then he sees somebody coming and approaching them in the dusk light. But the person looks wounded. And there's a big gash. Like that alligator clip. What's observed by both of them is the man is bleeding, and it's very obvious. He has this severe wound. So the first thing that happens is the man passes out, and the emperor rushes over and starts to tend to the wound, starts cleaning it, runs down to the creek, gets some water, starts cleaning it, uses his shirt to wrap the wound, and throughout the next hour to two, he's refreshing the cloth with cleaning it because it's so saturated with blood. So this is really a messy situation, but both the hermit and the emperor take the man into the hut and place him on the hermit's bed. Shortly through the, you know, after tending and the bleeding stops, the man recovers consciousness. And he's very shocked that the emperor is tending to him. And he asks, please forgive me. And the emperor just can't figure this out. Well, why should I forgive you? I don't know what's going on. Turns out the man was on a pilgrimage himself. He was coming to kill the emperor because the emperor's army had killed his brother and had taken away all of his land and other property. And so he was going to avenge his brother. So while he was waiting, because he knew the emperor would probably come back the same day, he was waiting to ambush him down the road and got tired of waiting. Why wasn't the emperor showing up? What was, you know, he couldn't quite figure that one out. So he, of course, went to find out and then met the attendants of the emperor who caused this wound to happen, and the man escaped. The emperor was, you know, quite shaken by this. Once he heard this story, he was amazed, though, that in fact a man and himself could reconcile their differences so easily. And he intended to return the property to the man. He said, yes, you'll have it back, and my attendants, my physician will tend to your wounds to ensure that it heals. And so now, it was really late, and he ended up falling asleep. And by morning time, well, he still hadn't had his questions answered. And he was just like, well, I'm going to ask the hermit again, which he did. This time the hermit said, well, you already have answers to all these questions. You don't need to ask me. So the three questions were, what is the best time to do each thing? And the hermit said, when the man came up, you took care of him. If you hadn't helped me with the hoeing, you would have gone down and been killed or mortally wounded. You know, something would have happened to you. So the best time, whatever you did, was what was in front of you. And who are the most important people to work with? Well, those that are here with you right here, right now. As he helped the hermit, and then as he helped the wounded man. And then, what was the most important thing to do at all times? To be with what was there, to pursue just this. So emperor got his answers and was able to return to his everyday life. So how is our life like that? As I said, I had been so taken with the mindful eating material that Jan Chosen Bay had written. And so when she came out with this one, I read an excerpt via email. I'm sure that's how everything comes to us today. I still need some work. And she seemed to have some really good suggestions. So I'm going to share one with you that I tried out earlier in the week. And the topic is waiting. We all know how to wait, right? maybe not know how to wait. We know we wait, right? We wait in traffic. We wait in lines for groceries. At the grocery store, we wait in lines to buy tickets at the movie theater. We queue up for a lot of stuff, right? I mean, this is just everyday life. We're waiting. So waiting can happen to any of us all day, throughout the day. One practice is to actually open yourself to the sounds around you. And there have been times when I've been waiting for people to return to the zendo, and I'm standing outside the threshold and listening to the birds and listening to the sounds of the vehicles, of the... sometimes you can hear other sounds, other animals, sometimes there's talking, but there's a lot of sounds. Sometimes the wind is picks up and comes through the trees. So listening to sounds while you're waiting. One instruction was also to take a few breaths when you recognized you had to wait. So all of a sudden as you queue up, it's like, oh, this line is going to take forever. Why aren't I in that line? Because you're in this line. And you know as soon as you go to the other line, it's not, this line's going to move. This is a game. I don't know if you play it, but I play it. I play it on the freeway when I'm, you know, like things aren't working. And you think, well, this line's faster than this lane. And what shows up is impatience. When I lived in L.A., I used to be on the 405 regularly, daily. And if you, unfortunately, try to switch lanes, you can get a ticket for switching lanes. And if you stay in one lane, you'll realize that switching lanes makes no sense because, 2 hours later, you're still on the same freeway, and when you're exiting, you'll see the other car that you've been tracking yourself against two cars up or two cars back. They all are moving at the same, pretty much the same rate, just not at the same time you are. But we like to think it's moving faster. So what it pointed out to me was a lack of patience. So waiting. Part of this exercise is first, you have this, you take a topic, and so mine was waiting, and then you practice it for the week. So I did that starting on Monday, and by Monday evening when I was on the freeway again, on the 85, I just pulled up onto the freeway in the afternoon, it's 5 o'clock, I didn't even get to the next exit, and I was stuck in traffic, stopped. Oh, waiting. Yes, that word came up. And then I practiced the exercise of taking three deep breaths and then started to look around. And I looked at the different kinds of cars, saw some new makes of cars and colors of cars I hadn't observed before. I watched the clock, which is another thing about waiting, watching clocks. You can put a W on the clock or on your phone, when you're waiting, because that's one of the things we do. We check the time. We check our clock. Did you ever see when people start queuing up, the minute they have some spare time, they look at their phones? In business, this is what people do. They look at their phones. They all want to escape waiting. Waiting. But, waiting isn't bad, right? So what I learned in my waiting is that I knew from experience that I had enough time to get down to Scotts Valley, which was my destination, and that I didn't have to get anxious because I could start feeling anxious about this. The anxiety level was starting to go up. I wanted to be moving. I did not want to be waiting in traffic. And as soon as you give up that desire, that wanting something other than being where you are, and consider the gift of time returned to you. Now you had some time. It was waiting time, but it was a gift. And you You know, I found myself not only seeing other things, but hearing other sounds that I really, you know, being stopped in traffic, other sounds show up other than just the roar of the cars. So you could tune into that, and it can be a positive experience instead of what normally happens in waiting is the negative. It's like, oh, I'm waiting. I'm going to be late. You know, it's all these other feelings. The anxiety levels go up. So this practice of waiting is a choice you can make. Is it a thief moment or is it a Zen moment? The thief moment is you got caught in the desire to be someplace other than where you were, as opposed to this exercise that exercises that Jan presents have different components. They first describe, she'll describe the exercise, then she'll have a section about how do you remind yourself that you want to pay attention to something. And she had mentioned using this little sticker of a W that you could put on your clock. For myself, I believe in intention. So I had set forth my intention when I wake up in the morning that I'm going to pay attention to waiting, my response to waiting. And so, of course, when waiting time showed up, I could recognize it because that's what an intention will do. It will help you remember. So remind yourself. And then after you have that experience, then, you know, what did you learn about it? What are the discoveries about that mindfulness experience, that event? It takes many events like this to undo our habitual way of thinking, our habitual way of responding. So all these little helps are really there to help us continue and move forward in our practice with continued effort. Dan also offers way to look at it at a deeper level with each of these practices she's proposing. And as I said, she pointed out that waiting, a negative response to waiting, was really about impatience. So it gives me now another subject to start investigating in other aspects of my life, because it's probably there and I'm not seeing it. And then her final words are always around that particular mindful exercise. And in this case, her final words were, don't be annoyed when you have to wait. Rejoice in extra time to practice being present. So the other subjects she has, this is just a few, but you can imagine how useful they could be. One is to look at the wind, or, you know, observe as a subject the wind, or light, a smile, or to notice trees. Look up. Do you ever notice when you're walking on a hike, everybody's looking down? We're all watching to make sure we don't trip over something, I'm sure. But we don't really look up. And then when you have the exercise she proposes, you can start appreciating how really habituated we are in all of these aspects of just everyday life. These are things we experience every day. So look up. notice those trees, especially through the seasons. And also, being a Wisconsinite, I had the great pleasure of seeing trees without leaves on a regular seasonal basis, as well as, you know, in color, right, full color. And when you start seeing trees in their shapes, they're extremely beautiful. And it takes a little more effort to observe our trees here because they're, you know, all in greenness. But the greens aren't all green. They're gray. And they have some blue in them, too. So it's up to you to be mindful. This is a wonderful practice. And I encourage you to consider the approach Jan has. You may be able to develop it even further for yourself. Like, what things are you not seeing, not paying attention to? For myself, this combination of mindfulness and intention, to me, is like a dynamic duel. You know, it's like the tools in your toolbox. There you've got something that if you work with this on a daily basis and try out these practices, which is really just another extension of our practice from sitting on the cushion. So I just encourage you to give it a try.